You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs Program for Land's Sake. I'm Bill Kite, your host, and today our guest is Jamie LaRue, who's the Executive Director of the Garfield County Public Library District. Welcome, Jamie.
Hey, Bill. Pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you here, too. Thanks for coming. Before we get started, though, I want to say I have a huge bias for libraries, and basically, I want to offer a disclaimer that that's the way it's going to be. I'm for libraries, always have been as a child. I had a library card at an early age, and my four daughters, when they reached 5 years old, we got each of them a library card.
What a good dad.
And basically, you know, libraries are what I tend to go to now more than ever because I don't want to keep buying books when I can check them out at the library. And one of those books was Beyond the 100th Meridian, which was by Wallace Stegner. And really, I've told this story before on the air, but it caused me to want to get into public land management. So books are very important, libraries especially important. And we'd probably get into a lot of different things here if we could, like what it's like being a librarian in the U.S. in 2025 and how modern libraries change, how the community process works for discovering books to have in the library and what books not to have, how libraries build community and create early literacy. And, of course, there's a Spanish outreach in our communities here in the Valley. And we have some beautiful buildings thanks to the tax that was passed, and I voted on that myself. So
thank you.
You bet. And so we can talk about a lot of these and may get to some of them, but my first concern is the rise in censorship, Jamie.
Yeah.
And I'd like for you to address that, if you could, a little bit on how that's affected your job in Garfield County.
Well, I'm happy to talk about that. I've thought a lot about this, and I figure over the course of my career, I've probably dealt with some 1,200 attempts to have library resources either restricted or removed altogether. And as the more I think about this, you say, okay, well, why does somebody want to do that? I think that there are four key reasons. The first one is personal prejudice. You walk into a place and you see something that you don't like or something that you disagree with, and you have this natural, why is that there? I don't want to see that. And that's natural and it's common. It's just human. The second one is when I was the director of the Douglas County Library, I got 250 attempts to have books removed.
Wow.
And I thought, what's this about? And when I got to about 150, I spread them out on a big table in front of me, and I thought, what's the common denominator? And it suddenly jumped out at me that 99% of the books that I had fell into one of two categories. They were being challenged by parents of children between the ages of 4 and 6, or parents of children between the ages of 14 and 16. And all of a sudden, I realized then it's not about, at least back then, it wasn't about right versus left or religious versus secular. It was about parents who were having trouble letting their children grow up. You know, what happens between the age of 4 and 6? It's the end of infancy, beginning of childhood. 14 to 16, end of childhood, beginning of young adulthood.
Right.
And what happened was, I would call it a parental panic. I don't want my baby to grow up. Come back. Come back. And so that allowed me to kind of deal with them with more compassion and say, trust me, the library is the least of your worries. And in fact,
right.
We will help your child get through whatever crisis they may be facing. And then I went to work for the American Library Association as the director of the Office for Intellectual Freedom. And there I saw a different kind of panic. Like if you took a look at the top 10 most challenged books in the United States, they were all coming, they again fell into two categories. Books by or about LGBTQ+, or by or about people of color. And all of a sudden I realized this was a demographic panic, where suddenly if you're straight and white and you say, it's all supposed to be about me, who are all these people that now want to tell their own stories? And it's like, well, they were struggling with the loss of national identity, I think. And then when I came here, I saw, and this is happening all across the Western Slope, all across the United States, the rise of a new kind of censorship. And I just call it the will to power. It's that they want absolute control. 100% of the books in a library have to be about straight white people. 3% is not, you know, can't allow that. And it's the attempt to quash dissent. And I view this as a significant challenge to our nation right now and our communities. And I'm very proud to be working in libraries where we still believe you're supposed to tell the human story, everybody's story.
Very, very true. Well, you know, you have a book out, that, in case people don't know this, it's called On Censorship, A Public Librarian Examines Cancel Culture in the U.S. And so that can help people, too, if they find a copy of that. I know I have a copy.
Well, it's a short book.
It is.
It's that's the main thing book. To notice. I try to keep it short. It's a bathroom book. But yeah, and it's interesting. At the time that I published that, it was just kind of an essay. But it took off, and because this is one of the key issues our society is facing right now. So good timing.
Earlier I mentioned about building community. How do libraries build community?
Yeah, you know, so this is one of the things that I have now seen in all of the libraries that I've worked at. You start off thinking, okay, we have a small children's collection, right? And so why do people go to the library? And if you were raised at the library, kind of sounds like you were when you found it,
yep.
As was I, people grow up and they read, and then all of a sudden there comes an age where they drift off. What brings them back? Children, right? And so uh-huh. First it's what to expect when I'm expecting, and then it's like, you know, here's free entertainment, and I'm bringing my child in so they can see other children in the community, and I'm sitting down next to a mom or a father who also has a child about that age, and we start to talking. And that business about just coming together to hear stories, to listen to each other, to hang out in the same space, to have meaningful conversations, that is one of the beginnings of communities, moms and kids. And then I find as you get older, too, it's everything from the teens who are investigating graphic novels or sex education or just the more complicated area of romance. You know, I'm falling in love. I've got all these feelings. What does that even mean? And then they find out that other people have been talking about these things for a long time. Then we have adult discussion groups and book clubs and meetings and community gatherings. And all of these things are ways that we allow a community to have conversations with itself.
Yeah, my wife has a book club that she really enjoys, and people come from different places to be in the book club. So I think that's a really wonderful thing. How do you grow library leaders? I know you have a tremendous staff. Every time I've ever been to any of the libraries, I've been very impressed by the staff that's there behind the desk.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, I agree. I think I love those people. And I had this big realization. You know, it's funny. People often talk about, like, do you have a mentor? Who was your mentor? And I had a series of really bad bosses, and I learned a lot from them. Like, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. And one of the things that irritated me the most as a young professional was, like, I've got ideas. I want to try things. How do, you know, allow me to explore? And I always resented it when people would try to shut me down and say, well, no, you don't have the skills. You don't have, well, how am I supposed to get the skills?
Right.
And so what I have tried to be as a boss is to say, we hire people who are smart and they have a heart for service. And then we put them out there and say, now, we hired you for your brain. Use it. We hired you for your heart. Use it. And I want to, the greatest pleasure that I get as an administrator, I like to see people grow.
Absolutely.
And if we can put them in a spot to say, what are the resources you need? Is there a class I can send you to? Is there, you know, do you need additional people to come with you? Do you need some money for a conference? Let's put you out there because I want you to grow. I was cutting this up the other day, and I realized that in the time that I've been a library director, I think I now have had 13 people who have gone on to become library directors.
All right.
And I think that's marvelous. I think we're supposed to be community leaders and be forces for literacy and critical thinking.
And there's something you've did for the museum, the Glenwood Springs Historical Society's Frontier Museum, and the society itself. I'd like to have you tell that story instead of me.
Well, a couple of things about that. First of all, I had the pleasure to work with you, Bill. That was that was its own reward. But we began to notice, and as I was fairly new to the community, and I would go around and talk to various museums around the community, and I was astonished by the depth of the treasures that we have squirreled away in these older buildings and boxes. And I thought, oh, how do we, as a new person to the Valley, I was like, how do I connect to this? How do I understand the story of the place that I live in now?
Land. It's about the land.
Right.
Yeah.
It's about the land.
It's a place.
It's about the people.
The people, you know, exactly.
But certainly influenced by the
right,
land.
Right, for sure.
And so I had, I said, you know, it would be useful for us as a library to put together a new position, an archivist intern, and say, let's put them out there to work with some of the museums and understand what the principles are, what the issues are with cataloging historic artifacts and historic documents. That's very different from what public libraries do, which tends to focus more on current culture. And so we hired Ari and put Ari out there to work with the museum. And then at about that time, as I say to all my staff, I expect us to be community leaders. Find out something, find an organization that speaks to your passion, and let's volunteer. Let's figure out a way to help them, because the stronger we can make all these institutions, the stronger we're going to be as a community.
Right.
So I volunteered to serve on the board, and after a while found myself as president of the board for a little while anyhow. and it's like that, just that investment to say, I think it is the obligation of citizens to build strong institutions that serve everyone.
And I really do think you're doing a good job, and I appreciate that myself.
Well, thank you.
You mentioned about being a leader from the heart.
Yeah.
It's not just the brain, is it?
No, it really isn't. And, you know, I read this book some years back, and it was called The Happiness Hypothesis. And he said something that really stayed with me. This was Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-T, I think.
Uh-huh.
And he said, we are not thinking creatures who feel. We are feeling creatures who think.
Oh, I like that.
And I believe that's true. It's like, you know, you read all these wonderful stories about people that suffer kind of a brain injury, and all of a sudden their cerebral cortex goes down. And I used to say, like, you know, so you wake up, wouldn't that be great? Because all your emotions disappear. And now you are no longer befuddled by all of this feeling. You can say, that's logical or that's not logical, Captain, like Leonard's, you know, like Dr. Spock, Mr. Spock.
Yeah.
And but then it turns out that when people have had those kinds of injuries, they can't make decisions at all, because they get up in the morning and they say, okay, I'm going to have cereal because it's good to have fiber. Well, maybe I should have eggs because you got to have protein. And back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And it turns out the way we make decisions is you wake up and your gut says, I'm having eggs. And then you arrange the evidence to justify that decision. We decide with our heart, and then we arrange everything with our heads.
You know, let's try to put in perspective here the two words you used earlier that are kind of go counter against that, and that those two words are cancel culture.
Mm.
And I know a lot of people are befuddled by those, you know, those two words. So help us understand a little bit about what's going on with that.
Well, cancel culture was a term that was tossed out mostly from the right, mostly from the political right. And it was the idea was that people of conservative viewpoints were being canceled. So they would book somebody for a speech, someone would protest and say, oh, no, we can't allow that person to happen. And for a long time, the poster boy for this was Milo Yiannopoulos. And he was the bad boy of the right. And, you know, even though he was gay, and you could feel that there was some tension with the Republicans kind of accepting this. And then what would happen is the young Republicans would invite Milo Yiannopoulos to come to campus and talk for the young Republicans. And he would show up and be such a polarizing figure because he would fat shame the woman in the audience. He would make all kinds of transphobic comments, even though he was gay. And then he would get canceled. And then all the publicity would come around this. And so the young Republicans in the local university would get lots and lots of attention and lots more members. And then Milo would go on to the next campus where the whole thing would start over. Well, then one day, Milo Yiannopoulos made the comment that he thought he didn't see anything wrong with a young man having a sexual relationship with an older man, even if the younger man was a minor. And that was a bridge too far for the Republicans. And since then, he has been canceled from all Republican appearances. But I think if you probe a little deeper what we mean by cancel culture, it is, in fact, the cancellation of culture. It's saying that because of your viewpoint, you cannot be permitted to speak. We're just going to pretend that whole thing doesn't exist. And so I want to be clear about this. I think right now most of the challenges that we're seeing in America to free speech are coming from the political right. But that isn't always the case.
You know? Right.
Sometimes it comes from the political left.
Yeah.
And I think that both of those, you know, the library is not a partisan entity. We reflect the whole story of our community, the whole political divide across the continuum in our culture. And cancel culture is something that we should all be opposed to, whether it comes from the right or the left.
Very true. I agree with that. You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs Program for Land's Sake. I'm Bill Kite, your host, and today we're privileged to have the Executive Director of Garfield County Public Libraries with us, Jamie LaRue. So here we go. Let's keep going on this. You have a website. Tell us about that.
Well, which website are you talking about? I have several.
Well, it's
there is a Douglas County, Garfield County Public Library District website. Is that what you mean?
No, you mentioned to me in the material beforehand that your website, you write about reclaiming a moral sanction from the public sector.
Oh, yes. You know, and that's really interesting. I had this kind of insight one day that I was doing a lot of reading about generations and how each generation has its own spin on the world. And I think I have concluded that baby boomers, my generation, have been institution destroyers.
Huh.
Before, you know, I was raised by two parents who were in World War II, and it was top down, and clearly that sort of organization from the top, FDR at the top, General Eisenhower as the commander of the troops, these, you know, all the greatest generation went out and fought all those things. They believed that that kind of concerted energy, organized from the top down, was how we win world wars and how we build strong economies. Well, when I was raised, child of the 60s, it's like when my parents would say, you can't fight City Hall, right? And that's just what you believe when you win the greatest generation. I would say, what do you mean you can't fight City Hall? There's a sit-in at City Hall.
Right.
You know, if there's anything we can agree about, it's that you can't trust anybody who runs an institution.
Uh-huh.
And so my observation is that every institution baby boomers pass through, marriages, schools, industry,
mm-hmm.
universities, we broke almost every institution we went through. And so part of that, I think, really goes back to a book I got totally absorbed by when I was in high school. It was Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, right? Yep. An objectivist, you know, and she was the one who made this argument that money is good, money is the value. A very powerful story told very, very well. And at that time in America, we still tossed around words like robber baron.
Uh-huh.
But after that, there was a shift to like Wall Street where greed is good.
Yep.
And one of the things that she said about private industry was that we had lost a moral sanction for capitalism. Well, I've since thought a lot about this, and I think that Ayn Rand made a lot of fairly fundamental mistakes about economics, about epistemology, about philosophy and whatnot. But I think she was right about that. If you want to encourage people to grow into more activity in our culture, you give it a blessing. You give it a moral sanction. And I feel like one of the things that I want to do, and I know that you have done this too, I want to be an institution builder. I don't want to tear things down. I think it's very, very easy to break these things that knit our community together, much harder to build them and sustain them. And so I feel like in many ways that's kind of like my life's work. I want to build an institution that people can trust.
Yeah, it's the trust is gone in a lot of people's minds toward institutions. So, yeah it's very important. You believe that the library is a fundamental dignity of inquiry.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
You know, so when somebody says, what's the purpose of the library? What do you stand for? And I always go back to this story. When I was 6 years old, I came into a bookmobile for the very first time, and Mrs. Johnson looked at me like I was the man she'd been waiting for all of her life. And she said, how can I help you? And I said, well, I read a lot of comic books. I was 6 years old, and I didn't know what librarians would think about comic books. I didn't know she might look down her nose at me. And I said, and I read about the speed of light. How did they determine that light had a speed? I thought it was like on or off.
Okay.
And then how did they figure out how fast it was? And then I kind of sat back and I thought, okay, here it goes again. I'm going to hear this. Why do you want to know this? Why, you know, what does this mean? And at that time, I had already heard a lot of criticisms of childhood curiosity. But Mrs. Johnson looked at me with her eyes aglow, all a twinkle, and she said, what a fascinating question. Let's find out. Mm-hmm. And I have come to believe that you can judge a society by how seriously it takes its children. And so if a child comes in to say, I have dignity and I have curiosity, and there is something honorable about that. And so when you walk into an institution, you say, I'm here because I have questions, and the whole institution was set up to respond to your curiosity. And I was overwhelmed at 6 years old by the benevolence of that arrangement, and I still think it's mighty fun.
Sure is it. Well, libraries are where people learn. And what are you most proud of as your tenure as executive director of the libraries that you've been able to lead?
You know, I think it goes from, you know, very much a sequence. When you first start working, and I worked at the Normal Public Library in Illinois, the most misnamed town in America, Normal.
But actually, a town named Normal.
There is a town named Normal. There is, in fact, I think there are five in the United States named Normal. But when you work, you know, as I say, libraries are service industries. That's why people are drawn to them. And when you hand the right book to somebody at just the right moment in their life, and you see the power of transformation, that's the first thing that hooks you. That's what I was proud of at first. Here's what made my day today. Then as I got on and I became an administrator, again, you make that shift. Now it's not direct delivery of services. It's investment in the people who provide that service. And so it's building an environment in which the culture rewards them for doing all the right things. And so, as I mentioned, I'm very proud of the fact that I have grown a lot of directors to go out there to try to build strong communities. And then the other thing is that there is some magic to the book.
There is, right? Isn't there?
You know, and it's like this is one of the things I think that drives a lot of librarians, is that there is still this reverence for the book. And so I am very... I had this dream one time. I died. I dreamt that I died. And after I died, I was in a bed and breakfast in Taos. And I thought, oh, so this is what happens after you die. You go to a bed and breakfast in Taos. And I went around and I was talking to all these people. I said, so what happens now? What goes on? And they said, we don't know. We just got here too. And all of a sudden, I was overwhelmed in my dream with sorrow because I had failed to write a book. I thought, the purpose of my life, I was supposed to write a book, and I never got around to it. And so you wake up and you say, well, gee, I wonder what that dream means. It means you're supposed to write a book.
There you
and
go.
So now I have this. I've written two books, both of them kind of about censorship, which is ironic. But I do have a sense of pride just of having something that I can put on the shelf alongside all of those other books that changed my life, that opened me up to things, and be part of that ongoing conversation across the generations.
All right. I'm still attached to the actual book that you can look and put down and put a bookmark in, and also that smells like the library.
I read something just the other day, and I thought of you when I read it. It was that there is something magical about trees, you know, the smell of trees. And so almost anybody I know that loves books and, you know, that kind of outdoor thing, you open up a fresh book or magazine and you stick your nose in the middle of it. That smell of trees, that's pretty powerful stuff.
It is, isn't it?
But having said all that, having moved a couple of times now and recognizing that I had to move, no joke, 3 tons of books that I've collected, it's like I don't buy books anymore.
Yeah.
You know, like I check them out from the library, I return them, I buy books from bookstores and I give them to other people. But I mostly read electronically these days because I can carry around 100 books and it fits in my backpack.
Well, yeah, not thinking about that, the last two books I read were electronic books. The Emerald Mile was one, and then the author wrote A Walk in the Park. So
wonderful.
So, yeah, and there is a program called Libby.
Yes.
That I liked it.
Yeah, it's an application that taps into the OverDrive collection of about 1.5 million electronic titles, so, yeah.
Yeah, it's been good. I like it too that you can carry it around. But I'm still a person that likes those.
That's okay.
Those books.
The book has endured for thousands of years.
It has, hasn't it? The other day I read somewhere where that a Bible was found that was like 1,000 years old. It's pretty amazing. The books can still be preserved that long. I don't know that too many of our books are going to be preserved. I don't know unless they're on good paper.
Well, there you go.
Change. What change do you see coming to libraries that you can either try to be prepared for or try to find out more about?
It is my belief that what libraries do is hold up a mirror to our culture.
Okay.
And one of the things that's happening in our culture, there was like these inflection points. One of them was the rise of previously marginalized voices. You see this in history, you see it in museums, you see it in libraries, you see it in film, people whose stories we hadn't told before. And so beginning to collect those was one of those inflection points. Then the other inflection point has come where I think now there is a strong authoritarian wave, not just in the United States, but we're seeing it pretty much around the world. And I think that, so how do libraries get ready for this? It's like, well, we continue to reflect the conversation that goes on about that. We fend off those censorship challenges. And I think that we continue to do some of the things you rattled off at the beginning. We invest in the minds of our children. Early right. literacy is the best defense. You should be able to figure out if somebody's lying to you. You mm-hmm. have to know how to read to do that. We have to continue to build local community, because as we fray at the national level, one of the ways we hang together is to build those bonds locally.
Right.
So I think those are kind of the big things.
In the couple minutes we have left here, what can people do to support libraries?
Well, I have learned that that's almost backward. The question is, what should we do to support you?
Okay.
It is not the job of a community to make a great library. It's the job of a library to make a great community.
So
what that comes down to is visit. You know, come. Yeah. Actually, I would start with this. Figure out what you can teach and go to the library and say, can I present a program on this? Because why not share your knowledge with the rest of the community? And I think tapping the wisdom of a local community is a smart idea for libraries.
Well, there you go. Completely opposite of what I was thinking about. Okay. And what's your next challenge that you see in your job?
We have gone, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, over the past 3 years, a small group of people has kind of claimed that certain books were dangerous and tried to get them removed. They were not successful, but they were successful in persuading the county commissioners that they should take over the selection process for our trustees. We now have three of our trustees that are up at the end of this year, and I'm hoping that we can change the conversation about this too. It's like, let's stop fighting with each other internally, and if someone says, my viewpoint isn't presented, then let's tell us what you want to see, and we'll add it. And so let's try to find ways to team up across governments to raise the level of knowledge, to raise the level of understanding.
Great. I'll go along with that. Thank you so much, Jane, for being with us. And thank you for listening. You can listen to our show at KDNK on the second Monday of every month at 4:30. Until then, whatever you do to Mother Nature, do it for land's sake.